Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering, in your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, Dr. Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm good. It's been a while, man. I've missed you.
It's been a while. Something big happened since we've been away.
You were on Fox Fair and Balanced News.
That's true, but that's not what I'm referring to.
Oh, you... Okay, I'm at a loss.
You're not at a loss.
You
Nico
a kid.
Happened.
You're a kid, baby.
Yes, Nicolo Hugh Petrilli joined us on October 20th. Weighing in at 8 pounds, 14 and a half ounces, 21 and a quarter inches long. He's
a
big kid. I was always the smallest kid in my class my whole life. And lo and behold, my wife and I had a big baby.
Mm. Do you feel a new urgency about leaving no child behind?
I do. Or at least I feel an urgency about leaving this not leaving this particular child behind.
It's yeah. Good.
Mm-hmm. But as we'll talk about, Congress is not feeling such an urgency about leaving no child behind anymore. We'll
there you
talk
go.
About
you
that.
Go away to have your kid and Congress drops the ball.
Isn't that interesting? It is true. All of a sudden, no child behind reauthorization just falls apart.
Mike, you're a central guy. You're a cog.
Cog in the wheel. Well, good. Well, lots to do today, Rick. There are many interesting developments in the world of education policy, and I know that our listeners have missed their weekly dose of the Education Gadfly Show. So let's get to it.
Let's do it, baby.
All right. So we'll start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with Sheila Burt, who will talk about Fordham's new report on advanced placement and international baccalaureate. An interview hosted by Kobe Loop, our producer.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's right.
Whoa.
Getting some airtime. Good, Kobe. And then Liam will impart some education news of the weird. Sound good?
Works for me.
Christina, get us started.
Rick, No Child Left Behind reauthorization is officially dead for 2007. Is there any hope for 2008, 2009?
Huh. That's a good question. Well, given that the first thing we know is we can't actually ask the people who actually know what's going on because people on the Hill have been swearing up and down for 10 months that it would get done in 2007, even after everybody knew that was obviously untrue. The reality is no, probably no way it gets done in 08. It'll be really interesting to see if anything gets done in 09. The trick here is it's a political train wreck, Mike. I mean, this thing is all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you and I have written about how the Washington consensus gave birth to this law that at the elite level, Democrats and Republicans came together. But there is not support in the base of either party. And what's happened now is the National Education Association has declared war on No Child Left Behind. They've made it clear that they want a dramatic overhaul. And the Democrats in Congress have basically said, we're not going to cross the unions on this law.
You know, and meanwhile, on the Republican side, DeMint and Hoekstra have got a lot of folks mm-hmm. with them who are saying, my God, we bought a pig in a poke in 01 to do right. Bush a favor. And what's he done for us since?
Right.
And so now you've actually got a lot of pushback. The funniest thing, I think, in the scenario is that, you know, Clinton's obviously looking strong right now for 08. If she wins, it takes the bat right out of Miller and Kennedy's hands because they've been these key, valuable PR allies for the Bush administration. If Clinton moves into the White House and names the Department of Ed, it totally changes the profile of Miller and Kennedy, which means NCLB's got no high-profile friends left in power.
Right. And it's really starting to make it look like there was something unique happening in the late 90s and 2000, 2001, where you could get both political parties to go against their own bases. A Republican governor calling for stronger federal control and Democrats going against the union. Those days appear to be over.
Mm.
Next up, California's exit exam appears to be leading to a dramatic increase in high school dropouts. Is this necessarily a bad thing?
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we've known for a long time that many high school dropouts aren't dropping out because they can't do the work. They're dropping out because they are bored to tears and not being challenged. It could be that finally, if we have, you know, exit exams that mean you have to meet some minimal standard, that the types of people dropping out will change. High school won't be quite so boring and lacking in challenge anymore, so those people won't drop out. But you will see some dropouts from people who are getting high school diplomas they couldn't read.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things. There's at least two things going on here. One is that the benefits of high school exit exams are going to be long term. The idea is not that, oh, we adopt an exit exam this year, suddenly everybody's teaching better. And I mean, that's silly. The idea is that you change expectations on educators, on students, on parents. And so 3 years out, 7 years out, it has beneficial effects. The second thing is, frankly, if what's going on is you had kids who were getting a diploma because there were no expectations and no requirements, and now they're not getting a diploma because they can't pass the test. If that happens to be the population we're talking about, you know, what they were receiving was a worthless piece of paper. And I'm not at all sure that it's obviously bad that we've stopped giving out worthless pieces of paper.
Okay, but aren't the politics tricky here, Rick? Because, you know, overwhelmingly it's going to be minority children who are failing these tests. We see this in other places around the country. And that means that it's going to make, you know, lead to charges of racism. How do school reformers deal with that?
No, that's true. I mean, this is actually what undid the minimum competency testing movement in the late 70s, is you had massively disproportionate rates at which diplomas were being denied. You had lawsuits. You had a lot of second thoughts on the part of legislators. It'll be real interesting to see if this plays out any differently this time.
Okay.
Last one. The mayor of St. Louis is attempting to start a citywide system of charter schools similar to the one in Indianapolis, in which only the best applications are approved and school quality is monitored constantly. Rick, can it work in St. Louis?
Can it work? Sure. Sure it can work. There's a lot of questions here. There's a question about, saying that you're in favor of quality and accountability and monitoring is different from actually being able to monitor and ensure quality and accountability. It's a question of whether the mayor actually has the resources and the tools and the ability.
Well, and he doesn't. I mean, he has been asking for years for the state legislature to give him the power to authorize charter schools like Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson has had. By the way, Peterson, who lost in a surprise defeat the other day and is no longer going to be the mayor of Indianapolis, a real shock to the charter school world. Okay, but back to St. Louis. So Mayor Slay actually doesn't have any authority to start charter schools. All he's doing is saying, I'm going to use my bully pulpit and the authority I have as mayor to help with things like facilities and contracts to try to encourage the growth of a charter school system. I say hooray. I mean, other mayors should do that too. But he certainly doesn't have the tools to get the job done like a Bart Peterson had.
That said, could it work? Sure, it could work if all this stuff falls into plate. And if the mayor pushes, if the mayor really chooses to get behind this, things could go well. You never know.
Anything can happen. Is that what you're saying?
One's got to believe in blue skies.
Speaking of that, Rick, could it happen? Could Rick Hess be the next president of the American Enterprise Institute?
I'd say the odds on that in Vegas are long, long indeed.
Well, we'll check that out when we're in Vegas this spring.
Yeah, baby.
For the bachelor party of the century. Woohoo. Okay, well, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for our special interview with our special interviewer, Kobe Loop, and our special guest, Sheila Bird.
Sheila Bird.
And you're going to like her even more after this.
Joining us today is Sheila Bird, who was the lead author on the new Fordham Report, Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate. Do they deserve gold star status? Welcome, Sheila.
Hey, Kobe.
So, Sheila, let's talk just a little bit about what the goal of this study was, what you guys were trying to find out.
Well, what we wanted to do was take a peek under the hood of the Advanced Placement Program and the IB programs. They've both been around for a long time. They have a kind of a cachet and a kind of assumed level of rigor, and we wanted to make sure that that was really the case. There are a bunch of incentives, both at the federal and state level, for states to participate in these programs. There are a lot of philanthropists donating a lot of money to school systems to incentivize those school systems to take advantage of these programs. There are more and more people taking these tests. We know that lots of high schools are being judged based on the number of courses that they offer from these programs, and so we decided that it was a smart idea to really take a look at what was actually being taught and being tested, and whether or not that really did represent a kind of a gold standard for, in an ideal world, if it was the kind of stuff that we wanted our kids to know and be able to do when they left high school.
All right, so we have thousands and thousands of kids taking these tests, and so what'd you guys find out?
Well, what's really interesting, first of all, as somebody who has a long history looking at state standards and developing them and looking at state tests, what was most interesting to me was the fact that these independent entities have really developed what are essentially standards-based accountability systems that are, in many ways, much better than most state standards-based assessment systems. If you look, for example, at a lot of the high school exit exams, across the country, to the extent that states have them at all and to the extent that they count at all. I think we all know that most of them are assessing content and skills that are pretty typically taught at an eighth or possibly a ninth grade level. Whereas these programs, which are admittedly historically for the so-called advanced students, the content and skills and the program in general is just much more rigorous, much more efficacious for demonstrating whether or not kids are able to go out into the real world and do credit-bearing coursework in college. And
so is there a lesson here then? I mean, should the states be maybe trying to emulate these tests, or is there maybe just a, should we start relying on companies like AP and programs like IB to take over the exit exams and state tests and things like that?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to necessarily see that, but I think one of the recommendations we've made is that states ought to consider making their own high school exit requirements and assessments more like these programs, which are rich and rigorous and whose assessments really do have both selected and constructive response items. IB in particular has a really rich array of formative and summative assessments. And they're working, so either states should make their own systems that they're already spending hundreds of millions of dollars on every year more like these systems, or they might consider allowing these credits to serve as proof that they've met rigorous high school standards.
Mm-hmm. All right. So overall gold stars for them then. Would you say that either AP or IB, did either of them receive any demerits?
If you read the report, which we hope everybody will, there are some strengths and weaknesses in each one of the programs. You know, we looked at what are typically the core content areas, English, math, history, and science. And overall, English and science, biology was the course that we looked at, did the best. In math and history, we saw slightly lower grades, but still in the C+, B- range for both programs.
Okay. Any concerns going into the future?
Well, we had some concerns about kind of the amount and complexity and accessibility of some of the what I would call curriculum materials, course outlines, the way in which these programs describe the content and skills that teachers are supposed to convey to kids. They're pretty dense and pretty verbose in both cases. There's a little bit more prescription, which we think is a good thing, in the International Baccalaureate program, that teachers in the AP are given a little more leeway. So, for example, in the IB English, IB Literature course, or even in the U.S. AP English Literature course, because the teachers are given a lot of leeway about the books they select, there is a danger that American students might miss out on some essential U.S. literature if they hadn't already taken an American literature course. So we'd like to see a little more clarity at that aspect of the programs. In many ways, the exams themselves are better indicators of the priorities of the program developers. But it would be nice, especially for new teachers, if there was a little clearer guidance on the front end about what they were supposed to do without having to infer so much from past exams. That's one thing. In particular, in the advanced placement program, we're a little concerned, and the jury's still out, but it looks as though there's a redesign process planned. We know there's a redesign process planned, and it looks as if it could be moving in a direction that our reviewers were concerned about. And by that I mean that particularly in the history and the science courses, which are the content areas where they started, they have asked their content experts to define thematic overlays for the courses and enduring understandings and essential questions, sort of conceptual layers to the course, ostensibly in an effort to make them more coherent. But we fear that it may ultimately overemphasize themes and so-called conceptual thinking at the expense of actual content. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean narrative history, dates, events, people, facts in science. And we think that the programs do a pretty good job already of covering that ground. And if they go too far in the other direction, we're worried that some of the facts and may go to the wayside.
All right. Well, hopefully this report will kind of keep them in line, and we'll have to see what happens. But thank you, Sheila, for coming on the show, and we hope you'll come back.
Good talking to you.
So what do you think? First of all, we should have Kobe do all the interviews from now on.
Dude, I'm going to call Kobe Mike Wallace. No, I'm going to call him Diane Sawyer.
Ooh.
Or Barbara. Barbara, what's her name?
Walters.
What about Diane Rehm?
Or Diane. Well, no, I like Kobe's voice much better. But Kobe, stellar job, big guy. Outstanding. And I do like Sheila Bird. Sheila Bird rocks. Sheila Bird should be somebody even more important than she is. Huh. Somebody should name her to something.
Yeah, she is very important.
She is, but she should be even more so.
And this study is important. So, again, finding that AP and IB are, after all, quite good.
Huh.
So, what do you think? First of all, do you think we're going to get pushback from a lot of the conservatives about International Baccalaureate?
Yes.
Why do they hate this program so much?
Well, I mean, I think there are, you know, some of the writing prompts and some of the exercises and outline stuff does seem to get into the whole, I don't know, social studies movement. When you talk about framing questions about civil rights and international affairs in terms of, you know, quote unquote, social justice, you know, I mean, myself, sometimes I get my back up in hackles at some of the stuff they're suggesting. But
that's, you know, because you're a right wing wacko, Rick.
There you go. So, you know, I think that's it. But it's funny because, you know, because that's the thing, is that's what people see and react to.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily in a position to see and react to the caliber of the assessments or the rigor of the tests.
Well, it turns out it is a very rigorous, strong program.
Outstanding.
All right. Well, it's talking about rigorous and strong. It is now time for that time we wait for all week long. Education news of the weird time. With our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
10 pupils at Hunger Hill School in the United Kingdom are, as part of a pilot program, being tracked by radio frequency identification chips in their school uniforms.
Nice.
Officials hope the tracking will hasten registration, simplify data entry for the school's behavioral reporting system, and ensure attendance. But David Clowder doesn't like it.
Uh-huh.
Clowder, a parent and founder of the advocacy group Leave Them Kids Alone,
I love the British sense of humor,
told the Doncaster Free Press, quote, "With pupils being fingerprinted, and now this, it seems we are treating children in a way that we have traditionally treated criminals by tracking them with radio frequency identification chips," I guess. Hunger Hill's head teacher disagrees, quote, "The system is not intrusive to the pupil in the slightest." Rick, for or against tracking students with computer chips? Yeah.
Well, I got to say, having been a kid and a student, and
that's education news of the weird.
I gotta say, having been a kid and a student and having taught kids and students, I am quite confident that there are very few differences between kids and students and your typical criminal. So I think that this is probably, you know, this is probably a useful way to keep the young thugs on a line.
See, you know, here in this country, we keep giving students all these rights. You know, they have the right to free speech, you know, in high school. See,
yeah,
in England,
right to key your car.
Right. See, in England,
stick
they have
a kid in a locker.
They know how to, they know what they're dealing with. They understand.
It's, you got to get it. Oof. Oof.
Whew. Wow.
That was a nice one, Liam, I got to say.
Yeah. Although, Rick, see, you had the conservative movement with your blasting away at IB, but now that you're in favor of computer chips, I think you just lost them.
Well, but I'm keeping the social conservatives. I'm just losing the libertarians.
Good. That's good. Good triangulation.
me and Mike Huckabee.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. We will be off for Thanksgiving next week. Enjoy the holiday, all you listeners out there. But we will be back after that. And until then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.